Jack Cowan is a good friend of ours. He's well known to the Granaderos, has been a member of the Granaderos for a couple of years, 3 years.
Yeah.
And he is the founder of a rather new group here in San Antonio, the Texas Connection to the American Revolution. We call it TECARA for short. He's a retired U.S. Army officer, and that's about all I know him. Oh, yes, I know one other thing. You have a wonderful sister. And that's Corrine. That's Corrine back here.
And he's the senator of the American Revolution.
Oh, yes. He represents the SAR among us.
Thank you very much, sir.
You got it.
Thank you. I'm glad you didn't tell everything you knew about me. I'll start from right over here.
He's very wobbly.
That's fine. That's fine.
Oh, you can stand there rather than back here?
Yeah, I'll just stand here if everybody can see me and everybody can hear me.
Okay.
First of all, thanks for asking me to talk to you. And the subject, of course, was the first presidents of the United States, which I'm sure will be kind of a hold your hat type thing, because I'm sure that you haven't heard very much about these people. Several years ago, when I was working on the Galvez project and the TECARA and all, I came across a letter that was written to Oliver Pollock. And Richard and I were just talking about Oliver Pollock. He found his grave up there on the Mississippi border of Louisiana. And Oliver Pollock, I'm sure most of you know, or all of you know, was the go-between between the American Revolution, George Washington's Continental Service, and Spain. And he was the one that was the kind of the undercover agent that supplied George Washington with all those supplies from Spain via the Mississippi River. This was when Spain was not involved in the war, but still supporting the Continental soldiers. Now, what was interesting about this letter that I found to Oliver Pollock, it was from the President of the United States, and it was appointing Oliver Pollock the first emissary, or the first representative of the United States to Spanish Cuba. And it was signed and dated June the 2nd, 1783. Now, the first President of the United States, we are taught, was George Washington, and he didn't become president until 1789. So how can we have a letter from the President of the United States dated June the 2nd, 1783, 6 years earlier? And the President of the United States at that time was Alice Boudinot. And he signed his name as President of the United States under the Great Seal of the United States of America. Well, I'm going to tell you how this came about, because it is it's such a startling point in American history that very few people are known in our history classes. Our schools do not teach us. So I want you to go back with me to the formation of this great country of ours, back to 1774. In October 20th of 1774, the congressmen all, or the states all elected congressmen, and they all came and formed the First Continental Congress. They did this because they weren't getting in response separately to their complaints to the British Crown, and so they decided to join together and bring forth their grievances to the Crown. They realized at this point, of course, that they probably wouldn't get any response because the King of England just wasn't interested at all. So it was kind of a footnote or a first stepping stone to the organization of the United States of America. Now, they came together and formed the First Continental Congress, and they elected their first president, a guy named Walter Payton, or I'm sorry, Payton Randolph. Now, the Randolph name should be familiar with some of you, because that was the family in which Thomas Jefferson married into. And if you go up to Virginia, to his whole home place, you see his burial ground, that it's all full of Randolphs. Well, this is how Thomas Jefferson got involved in politics. It was through this Randolph family. And it was Payton Randolph that was a brilliant man at the time, and he was so important that they, of course, elected him the first president of the United Colonies of America. United Colonies of America. And that's what they called themselves. He was so important, of course, that George Washington himself called Payton Randolph the father of our country. That's how important Randolph was, Peyton Randolph. Now, they kept journals, of course, of these Continental Congress, and if you go through that journal, that early journal, 1774, it has in there that they elected Peyton Randolph as the first president and Charles Thompson as the secretary of the United Colonies of America. And also, if you go down, I've got the whole journal here, but if you go on down, it has in there that on September 30th, they resolved to halt all exports to Great Britain, Ireland, and the West Indies. And it goes on, and it says that on October the 18th, they approved the Articles of Association. Now, the Articles of Association they're referring to are the Articles of Association of the United Colonies of America. Now, this was not a constitution, but it was an organizational type event. This is where all the colonies did get together, and they banded themselves together as the United Colonies of America. They had not yet declared their independence, obviously. As I said, Peyton Randolph was called by George Washington the father of our country, and that's why he was called, because he was the first president of the first Continental Congress and the first stepping stone that formed this great country of ours. The next president of the Continental Congress was a guy named Henry Middleton. Now, Henry Middleton didn't serve very long as president because he was called to duty in South Carolina. That's where he was from. But he was there long enough to pen a letter that went to the king draw his ire, because the king immediately upon receiving that letter put him on a hit list. And he and various other colonists were wanted dead or alive. After him came John Hancock in 1775. He was elected president of the First Continental Congress. And John Hancock, we all know very well. He was the guy that was president during the Declaration of Independence. Now, we remember the Declaration of Independence. You think about it, and you see his name in big letters at the bottom of it. And then you see all these other signatures. But that's not how it was at all. There were two first copies of the Declaration of Independence. And the only people that signed that Declaration of Independence was John Hancock, President of the United States of America. That's how he signed it. And the Secretary of the United States of America, which was Charles Thompson. Those were the only two signatures on the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence that King George saw, those are the only two names he saw on it. The other signers of the Declaration of Independence didn't sign it for months, 4 or 5 months after the Declaration of Independence was sent to King George. And it wasn't until a year later that the signers were even made public. So it was John Hancock and Charles Thomas, who's next rung the line, of course. They were the guys that were sought after. In fact, they were Hancock was sought after so hard that they dispatched a general with an army to go after him up in Concord, which resulted in the Battle of Lexington, the shot heard around the world. That's what that was all about, trying to capture John Hancock. So this was the first time that the United States of America, the styling, the United States of America was ever used, was in the Declaration of Independence. The next president of the Continental Congress was Richard Henry Lee. This Declaration of Independence, I'm going to read you a part of it, and then I'm going to tell you where it came from. It says, resolve that these United Colonies are, and have right off to be free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to British Crown, and that all political connections between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved. You remember that because that's part of the Declaration of Independence. For probably what you don't know, because you've been taught that the Declaration of Independence was written by Thomas Jefferson, that paragraph in the Declaration of Independence was written by Richard Henry Lee. It was his resolution that was adopted and was the birth of, and is called the birth of the United States of America. The Declaration of Independence is called the announcement of the birth of the Declaration of Independence, or the birth of America. Announcement of the birth of the America. So now you know where that part came from in our Declaration of Independence. Now, I'm trying to hurry through this because this is a long talk, and I'm trying to get it down to about 30 minutes. Now, Charles Thomas, the Secretary of the United States of America, we've got to talk about him for a minute. He was the guy that designed the Great Seal of the United States of America. He was the one that did it. And it's the same seal that we have today with only minor changes having made. Now, Charles Thomas was very important. He was the genius of his time. When all the congressmen came, did their work, and then left and went back home, he's the guy that stayed behind. He ran the day-to-day action of the government. He's the one that did it. And he served in the government for 15 years, from the very inception, from 1774, all the way until the second Constitution of the United States was adopted in 1789, the one that we have now. So he is a very important man, and kept this country together all that period of time. After Charles Thompson, John Hancock, the next president elected was Henry Lorenz. Now, Henry Lorenz is quite a fella. Henry Lorenz, in his first act as president of the United Colonies of America, declared a Thanksgiving Day. Now, you're taught that it was Abraham Lincoln that started the Thanksgiving Days. Well, it was not him at all. It was this guy, Henry Lorenz. He's the one that started the Thanksgiving Day. In fact, he said, in his own words, and I'll quote him, it says, to adore the superintending providence of Almighty God, we will have a Thanksgiving Day. And that's where our first Thanksgiving Day in the United States of America came from. Henry Lorenz.
Presidential proclamation?
President's proclamation. That's right. Now, Henry Lorenz was also the first and only president to become a prisoner of war. After he had served as president, he went to Holland to try and get some money to finance the revolution. And on his way, he was captured by the British. And he was put in the Tower of London, and that's where he stayed until the war was over. And it's quite interesting that after the hostile elections went over, after the Battle of Yorktown, he was exchanged in the prisoner of war exchange for none other than Cornwallis, the top British prisoner. That lets you know how important Henry Lorenz was to these people. Yet virtually nobody knows his name. Now, of course, while he was president, he decided that he knew that we needed a constitution. And so he put the wheels in motion to start forming a constitution. After Henry Lorenz, the next president was John Jay. He was elected, and we know who John Jay was. He was the guy that did some of the treaties. What you don't know is that Henry Lorenz was the one that was appointed to go over and negotiate these treaties, along with Benjamin Franklin and John Jay. Well, we hear all about John Jay and Benjamin Franklin, but you never hear anything about Henry Lorenz, yet he was the primary negotiator for these treaties. Why is this?
John Jay negotiated in Spain. Sometimes.
Yes, exactly.
Trying to get money and assistance.
The next president of the United Colonies was a guy named Samuel Huntington. Now, Samuel Huntington did what none of the other presidents could do. He got all the 13 colonies to unanimously sign off on the Declaration, on the Articles of Confederation of the United States of America, the first Constitution of the United States. And it was called the Articles of Confederation of the United States of America, our first Constitution. And that was Samuel Huntington. He had served 17 months as president under the Articles of Association. And when they adopted the Articles of Confederation, the first Constitution, they thought so much of him, they elected him the first president of the United States. And he was the very first president of the United States of America. Samuel Huntington. Now, Samuel Huntington served during 1779-1780. This was probably the darkest period of time during the American Revolution. This is where they had the coldest winters. The troops were completely without food. They weren't getting paid. They were in mutiny. This is when Benedict Arnold betrayed us Later, the following year, Benedict Arnold burned Richmond for the British. During this time, they had a mutiny in Pennsylvania where the soldiers surrounded the congressman and held him hostage. This was a very volatile time. But during all this period of time, Huntington was able to get these 13 colonies to sign, during the darkest hour, to sign the Articles of Confederation of the United States of America. This was done for a perpetual union, and it says so in that article. It's a perpetual union. This is when they formed the actual Constitution, the perpetual union, which is known as the United States of America. And he was the very first president. After Samuel Huntington was Thomas McKean. Now, Thomas McKean only served for 4 months as president, and he was called off because of sickness in the family. So he couldn't serve any longer, so they elected in his stead the third president of the United States, a guy named John Hanson. Now, I'm sure that some of you have gone on the internet and pulled up John Hanson's names, and it claims that he was the first president of the United States. But he was not. He was the third president of the United States, as I have just explained to you. There were two others first. The first one was Samuel Huntington. Then came McKean, who only served for 4 months. And the third president of the United States of America was John Hanson. He was served from November the 5th, 1781, to November the 4th, 1782. It was John Hanson who was president at the time of the Battle of Yorktown. And it was John Hanson who signed as the president of the United States a letter to George Washington congratulating him for the victory at Yorktown. After John Hanson, the next president, the fourth president of the United States, was Ellis Boudinot. Now you remember I started off with this letter that went to Oliver Pollock from the president of the United States, President Ellis Boudinot. He was the fourth president of the United States and is the one that, of course, sent the letter. Thomas Mifflin was the fifth president, elected president of the United States. Now, Thomas Mifflin is kind of interesting because he's the one that was president when the secession completely ended. He was the president when the British had pulled out of New York. And this is when, of course, they decided to put the American army into a peaceful mode. This is when George Washington resigned as commander-in-chief. And he sent his resignation into and in front of none other than Thomas Mifflin, the fifth president of the United States of America. And what is so unique and ironic about this is that it was Mifflin who conspired and tried to have George Washington removed as commander-in-chief and General Gates put in his place, Horatio Gates. That effort failed, of course. George Washington remained the commander. Thank goodness. But it was none other than Mifflin, the same guy that George Washington gave his letter of resignation to. And that's kind of ironic. The next president of the United States is Richard Henry Lee. And you remember Henry Lee. He wrote that paragraph that went into the Declaration of Independence. He was the sixth president of the United States. The seventh was John Hancock. And you remember John Hancock was president under the Articles of Association of the United Colonies of America. Well, they thought so much of old John Hancock that made him the president of the United States, making him the seventh president of the United States. The eighth president of the United States was a guy named Nathaniel Gorham. Now, he served during a real problem because this is when the United States was in a civilian mode. They were not fighting a war anymore. They were fighting among themselves. They had boundary disputes. They had Indian problems. They had taxation problems between the states. Things are going pretty bad. So he served during a real bad problem. He was the president that negotiated all these settlements for the boundaries between the states and all the Indian problems that arose. He was a very important man. The next president, the ninth president of the United States, Arthur Sinclair, was perhaps the greatest president this country has ever known for two very important reasons. Number one, when he took office, it was during the Shays Rebellion. The United States was just about ready to teeter and fall, collapse within itself. He realized that our Constitution, the first Constitution, the Articles of Confederation of the United States of America, didn't really given up power to cope with the problems that we're developing in a civilian population. That is the problems of commerce, taxation. You see, the Congress had the power to tax, but they didn't have the direct power of tax. What the government did was say, okay, the states, you have the power to tax your people, and we expect you to give your taxes to the federal government to keep it afloat. So the federal government didn't really have taxation powers, you see. Well, the states, the various states, of course, during civil time, they had no real big incentive to collect those taxes and send them to the federal government. Not only that, the federal taxes, the taxes that they did collect, came from tariffs, and they were taxing each other. If one state moved their goods through another state to get them to a market or to a seaport, they taxed them to come through their state. And so these became kind of real problems. And there was a lot of problems developing. So this commerce became a real big problem in the civilian United States. Well, Sinclair realized this big problem was developing, and so he called George Washington and a guy named Mason together and said, I want you to go to Indianapolis and have a conference and start devising ways to correct the deficiencies in our Constitution. And it was that conference that started the ball rolling through the new Constitution that we have today. So that was Arthur Sinclair, was the guy that started the ball rolling for the new Constitution. But he did one other thing that was even far more important than that. It was under Arthur Sinclair who decided to have the Northwest Ordinances. Now, the Northwest Ordinances was probably the most important legislative event in American history, because it was the Northwest Ordinances that divided up that Northwest Territory. Now, immediately after the United States got their independence, they got the Northwest Territory, which doubled the size of the United States immediately. So they had all this land, but they had a huge war debt. They owed every country in the world. They wanted to get out from under any control or any obligation to any foreign country. Well, it was Arthur Sinclair who devised these Northwest Ordinances, whereby they divided up this territory and they sold it off to land speculators and to farmers. And they took that money that they raised and they paid off all these foreign governments. And it was because of that that the United States was able to negotiate totally independent treaties without any obligation to any foreign government. The most important legislative act in American history. It made the United States truly an independent country. After Arthur Sinclair, Cyrus Griffin was elected president, the 10th president of the United States. And then finally after him was George Washington, the 11th president of the United States. Not the first, by any stretch of the imagination, by any account. He was the 11th president of the United States. So why do we call him, and why are we taught in history that he was the first president of the United States? Well, he was, in fact, the 11th president. I mean, this is really a puzzle. Now, we say, he was the first president after the new Constitution. Well, that's a stretch, but it just simply isn't true. You see, the Constitution was adopted, and I'll read the end of the Constitution. It says, done in convention by the unanimous consent of the state's president, the 17th day of September in the year of our Lord, 1787. 1787, George Washington wasn't elected president and didn't take office until 89. Hey, 2 years later. Well, in defense of that, when they adopted this new constitution, they didn't make it effective until March the 4th of 1789. All right, March 4th, 1789. George Washington didn't take office until April 30th, 79, 2 months later. So who was president during those 2 months under the new Constitution? Well, none other than Cyrus Griffin. Hello? He still wasn't the first president of the United States under the new Constitution. So how do we come about saying he's the first president? Well, there's one other avenue to take. When they got this Constitution, the new Constitution together, you see, only a few states, 9 states, signed off on it. 4 states refused to sign the United States Constitution, the new one. They didn't want to sign it because they didn't like it. And they didn't sign it, all the states didn't sign and ratify the Constitution until after George Washington had been president for 2 years.
why did they not want this Constitution? Why was it so bad? Why were they so afraid of it? And why did they even sign it in the first place, the nine that signed it? Well, the reason the ones that signed it is because they were afraid if they didn't sign it, the United States would collapse. And that's why they signed it. And it's so ironic that the reason that they signed this United States Constitution is the very problem that caused the Civil War, was the Constitution. A default in the Constitution caused the Civil War. And I'll tell you about that. But anyway, when they decided that, well, we're not going to be able to have any elections with the election law that we have, so we've got to modify the elections in order to elect a president, because we've only got nine states that can vote. So they modified these election laws. And it was under the new election laws that George Washington was elected president of the United States. And that's how he was the first president of the United States under these new election laws. Not under the Constitution. Not in the United States, not in any stretch of the imagination, but only because of the new election laws. Now, we've changed election laws many times since then, but we don't start over with a new president any time we change it, do we? Of course not. George Washington, with all due respect, was the 11th president of the United States, not the first president of the United States. So why do we insist on calling him the first president of the United States? This is not an easy answer, not an easy question to answer. You have to kind of go back and read between the lines. The obvious reason, of course, is because the Constitution was in dispute. The states didn't want that Constitution. And why they didn't want it is expressed very clearly by a guy named George Mason, who was against the Constitution and wrote against it at the time. And he said this. Now listen closely, because this, he gets it right on the head. By requiring only a majority to make all the commercial and navigation laws, the five southern states, whose produce and circumstances are totally different from that of the eight northern and eastern states, will be ruined. For such a rigid and premature regulation may be made as will enable the merchants of the northern and eastern states not only to demand an exorbitant freight, but to monopolize the purchase of the commodities at their own price. For many years, to the great injury of the landed interest, the landed interest being the southern states, the people that dealt in agriculture. And it says that, we're going to say, an impoverishment of the people, and the dangers greater as the gain on one side will be in proportion to the loss on the other. Whereas requiring a two-thirds of the members of president in both houses would have provided a mutual moderation, promoted the general interest, and removed the inseparable objection to the adoption of the Constitution. He says it right there, black and white. This Constitution gave the power to the nine northern states, leaving the five southern states with no power whatsoever. And exactly what happened was that these nine northern states, northern and eastern states, passed all commerce laws, tax laws, that put 80% of the federal government's tax, 80% of the tax load, tax burden on the five southern states. 80% of the tax burden went to the five southern states. That's why they seceded from the Union. They didn't have any power to change these laws because they were a minority group. They couldn't possibly raise a majority to go against these laws. They had no alternative but to secede from the Union. That's why they seceded from the Union. It was because of the same reason the United States seceded from Great Britain. Over taxation. Taxation without representation. That's what it was all about. And so you see, the very thing that was supposed to keep this country together, cut it in half. We all know what happened. Lincoln got an army together, invaded the South, totally destroyed the South. There wasn't anything left of the South except the boundaries that had existed in the states. For 10 years after the Civil War, nobody, not one soul that served in the Confederacy, either in the Army or in any form of government, could serve in any capacity whatsoever in the southern states. For 10 years. So the southern states then, for 10 years after the Civil War, was run strictly by northern immigrants that served as our governors and our officials, our government officials. The southern states totally ceased to exist. Did this start a whole new United States of America? Well, basically it did, but we don't start off with a new president. just because we started over as a country. Of course not. But the real sin in all this, the real sadness in all this, is that over the years, we've totally disregarded these 10 presidents. We've acted like they don't even exist. We've just shoveled and covered up all their humongous contributions. These are the people that founded the United States. These people are more important, far more important than the Franklins or the Jeffersons or even Washington. These are the guys that actually formed this country, made it what it is. And here we are 232 years later, and it's still the most powerful country in the world. And we owe it all to those 10 presidents. And it is so sad that we don't even know who they were. Thank you very much.
Thank you.